You will also have four expertises, so you will get
six expertises.
As a rogue?
You get the four, plus Scout gives you two more.
Oh, shit.
Live from the Mundangerous Sanatorium in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 166 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking poxes, plagues, and pandemics, and how to make them count. But first, the rogue traders take their leave in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Rangerer favors all enemies and all terrains in the Character Creation Forge. So, Total Party Thrill is brought to you by Archvillain Games. They're having a Kickstarter from October 1st to 30th, apparently not Halloween, selling character sheet gauntlets, which are kind of like binders for your character sheet.
Have you checked these out?
Yeah, I took a look at them. They're
pretty cool,
they're
right?
They're like metal things.
Well, resin, yeah, like plastic things. But you like slide a sheet of paper into them and all of the trappings of your character sheet, like a D&D character sheet, are engraved into like the holder of the sheet. And you just fill in little windows that have space for, like, you know, your stats and your skills and all that stuff. You just like +3, +3, +4, +0, -1, like you just fill in the blanks.
Yeah, it's like a superhero mask for your character sheet.
Yeah, but it looks like the cover of the old like third edition books.
Yeah,
right?
Which were honestly some of the best covers that D&D has done.
They look like tomes. Yeah, right? Except they're like three dimensional and they have like depth and stuff. They're, you know, made of resin.
Well, apparently it's a patent pending design with figurine level detail, which I guess makes sense if you actually look at them, right? There's raised bits, like it has a tome with locks and things.
Yeah,
right?
Like the rogue one has like little bits of like a dagger and then like little potions or whatever, like smoke bomb things that are just kind of sitting in it. Like the wizard one is like dripping with arcane substances. It's really neat.
Yeah, just like a high-end mini.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are detailed covers for the fighter, the rogue, the cleric, and the wizard. So go screw, monk.
I mean, I'm sure that's going to be a stretch goal.
Yeah, yeah. You can get them painted or unpainted if you're really into that sort of thing. Shane, I don't know. Maybe you want to do that. You got washes.
Yeah, if I want to paint. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I would probably just get it painted. They are made of high durability ABS injection molded plastic. And they have spent over $40,000 on design and prototyping for this thing. They've gotten it patent pending, so I'm pretty sure it works.
That is more than I have spent on virtually anything. Certainly more than anything RPG related.
Yes.
We did not spend that much time or energy invested in this podcast, for example.
Yeah.
You can get a paint kit add-on from Army Painter. So when you're using it, you can open the cover to access the full character sheet in the front. You turn it over, and then you get a complete spell sheet on the back. If you don't like the standard 5e character sheet, which, you know, you can just use a blank sheet of paper, or really whatever you want.
Yep, it's designed to lie flat on the surface of the table and blend in nicely with your terrain and miniatures and everything else that you've got laid out there.
And there's a sliding tray to hold your character sheet that snaps into place. So you can head over to archvillaingames.com or search for them on Kickstarter to grab the gauntlet today. And of course, we have a link in the show notes. Shane, I am very happy to report that I think the Thrillicon bug is biting other people. Because
I'm sorry, what?
Well, right now, dear listeners, we are trying to plan Thrillicon, what, 2018.2?
This
would be the
0.5.
Okay,
we're halfway to 2019.
Okay, works for me. The second one where we go away for a weekend and just play games. I have a friend who, to be quite fair, I don't know if it was inspired by us, but they're doing it and we did it first, so I assume it must be inspired by us.
No one has ever done a gaming retreat before.
No, we were the first last year, patent pending.
Do they have a pithy name too?
They certainly do.
Okay.
They are going away to a house playing one D&D campaign for the whole weekend. They just hit level 4 in Curse of Strahd, so of course they're calling it Vampire Weekend.
Oh, man.
I love it. I wish I was there right now. Strahd is the kind of villain that you want to like have a solid 2 days
that
to
you
go up against.
Dedicate a weekend to.
He just gets creepier and creepier. Wait, he's here again. But he hasn't gone away. He hasn't killed us.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our next Thrillicon, because I am behind on mini painting. So I've got a ton of stuff assembled that I need to get painted, and I'm gonna do that.
You and Susie sitting there at the table while, I don't know, the rest of us cry or something.
Right.
Don't make me stare into the abyss again.
Speaking of staring into the abyss,
Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40k Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And on the lush and fertile world Malajakt, the Rogue Traders and the survivors of their two best companies of armsmen have been guests in the Verza House, the beautiful fortress manor of Lord Harlock. But after learning of the true warpy nature of the engine that powers the complex, they have elected to smash it with a massive power sword called a clave.
It is really the only thing that we do correctly, which is, it's the warp.
Smash.
Yeah, stab it. I mean, I feel that way every time our astropath Flair, speaks.
Well, you say you did correctly, but if you recall, there was a round of intense debate on what the correct thing to do was.
We should study it. We should smash it.
Yeah.
I'm glad that Trix made that decision for us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm holding the clave.
Right.
No one's trying to stop me, and even if you do, I don't think you could.
So a light flashes, there's a loud ring of a bell that deafens everyone, and when everything resolves again, you have returned to the dead world of Malajakt in the 41st millennium, just as you left it.
Lovely.
Lord Harlock and his chief engineer Jack are gone, as are all of the attackers who are on the verge of overrunning the fortress that you were desperately defending.
Oh, actually, okay, cool. Great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm into that. Why? We don't really have any answers, but something else is gone too. The psychic interference that was playing havoc on our Vox links and preventing the aforementioned astropath Flare from connecting to the warp and from sending communiques to other psychics on the planet, namely our tiny Inquisitor.
As if on cue, the regiment's chief comms officer, Lieutenant Castus, happily reports that he has established a stable Vox link back to base.
Yay! They were worried about us, weren't they? Definitely sending reinforcements. Man, they have been en route for days.
Worried is an interesting way of describing it. I think more annoyed that you haven't checked in yet is probably the more...
Right. Oh, those rogue traders haven't checked in, but you know how they are.
Like, they're either dead or will be soon, so they haven't escaped. We know that.
So, we do report in. We tell them the location of the Verza House and request reinforcements from that Inquisitor, Felicitas, who, by the way, is 14 years old. In the process, we also invoke a specific code phrase that Roth's agent, Major Barrow, had given us, so that Roth knows, and the Inquisitor hopefully does not know, that we are interested in some sort of partnership to get us all out of this mess without dying.
So the Inquisitor only needs the information that you guys have collected from the library and from your experience with the engine that you have destroyed. So she orders you to just abandon your post and return post-haste. Which, isn't easy to do.
Yeah.
Like, if you recall, the surface of Malajakt is like craggy and desert and like full of this very fine suffocating dust and these terrible dust storms and bad feelings, and just it's a miserable place. You also have a lot of wounded men. It's going to be very hard for you to make this journey in any type of time before the environment just keels you over.
Yeah, it isn't. They are not bad orders per se. They are just extremely difficult orders in our current situation.
Yeah, they're just very naive to the realities of marching a regiment anywhere.
All right, look. I'm really glad that you destroyed the ring. Now just walk back through Mordor.
Right. Just come home. We'll have a meal waiting for you. Good work.
And we were like, we're going to need you to send some eagles.
Yeah.
Okay. We need some eagles.
She's like, well, I can't send you eagles, but I can send you some reinforcements that can meet you along the way. So she does. She dispatches Roth and a contingent of troops to kind of, meet you halfway, reinforce you, make your journey survivable. But she insists you leave immediately.
Which, like, sounds great, actually, because we may actually get a little bit of time to talk to Roth one-on-one and see if, like, there's a deal
right
in the works without her around, which would be nice.
Yeah, you get the impression that he volunteered.
Yeah. So we suffered nearly 90% casualties, including those wounded who we thought would never be able to get back to base because there's just no way that they can make a five-day trek through a desert. But it does seem like all we need to do is trek out for, what, a day or so and hopefully meet up with Roth.
Yeah, I mean, you're just not capable of making great pace.
Yeah.
But yeah. So you leave the relative comfort of the Verza house for the heat and dust of Malajacht, setting out across a dusty valley littered with dried skulls.
And we'll find out what meets us next week.
So this week, we're talking about an esoteric topic, if you will. Making disease matter in role-playing games.
Yeah, that's gross.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You should just play more Nurgle games.
Yeah, right? Nurgle rot for everybody.
Right.
Did I save? No, you didn't. How did I contract it? You're in this game.
Okay, so what is what's the problem with disease? Like, why doesn't disease matter anyway?
Yeah, it's kind of annoying because almost every game has some sort of disease or disease mechanic. You know, they're in a book somewhere, but no one really uses them because it's really difficult to find a sweet spot when you are using diseases. Like, either they're easily solved. You know, in most fantasy games, there's some sort of healing magic like Cure Disease or Restoration or Paladins of Lay on Hands. And these are all available at pretty low levels, and they immediately and completely end normal diseases, right? So there's only really like 5 sessions of gameplay where you've got a disease that's actually dangerous. But of course, at the same time, everything is dangerous. So like there's nothing special about a disease.
Right. Yeah. What's going to kill you in a month to 6 months to years from now is not nearly as important to you as the goblin that is going to kill you with that arrow right now.
Right. And maybe that goblin is diseased. Okay. But I mean, the arrow is still the part dangerous. The other option is that you get these save or die mechanics. You know, at low levels, you catch a disease that either is fatal, right? It just kills you because you have 8 hit points, or it's enough of a drawback that the goblin can kill you because you're hobbled or can't see very well. But at high levels, if you have a disease that's strong enough to actually affect or hurt really powerful characters, it's likely either just going to like kill you outright or completely incapacitate you to the point where you may as well be dead for this session, which is boring.
Yeah, it turns out that like terminal cancer patients don't make very exciting adventurers.
No.
Or at least not very active adventurers.
Unless you're playing Shadowrun.
Right. Unless you're just synced in.
So a lot of GMs end up turning their disease into a MacGuffin that has an extremely specific cure. This works, but it basically makes your disease a curse, and it's essentially a plot point.
Yeah, and you can also only use that disease, or any disease that way, once, right?
Yeah, like, in like a whole campaign.
Yeah, you can't just keep getting these diseases that have very esoteric, specific cures, like... That doesn't feel special after the first one.
Right. You don't have lycanthropy and also vampirism,
right,
and also a zombie curse. Plus, there's the mummy rot. It's like, I don't know. Can we just get spacesuits?
Dude, can you keep it in your pants? Stop jumping in bed with undead.
It's this sexy mummy.
You got to wrap it up with mummies.
All right. So when you're thinking about diseases, you do want to consider verisimilitude. And honestly, I think you should, for the most part, ignore it, but take inspiration from real life. Like, actual diseases in real life take days or weeks to incubate and often just as long to cure. Or they just never get cured and, you know, your nose falls off in 20 years.
Okay. A different form of mummy rot. It's mommy rot.
Or, you know, it just hinders you for the rest of your life. All of those options are pretty bad in a tabletop game. So in RPGs, your diseases should be fast acting. You can maybe catch them even in one round and start showing symptoms immediately within seconds or maybe the end of combat or a few hours from now. But you can use tropes from real life to give your players a lot of info about that malady. You know, we're used to hearing about real life diseases and, you know, how you might catch them and how you might spread them and how you might cure them.
Yeah. So when you contract disease, typically you have a saving throw or some type of check after you've, you know, usually taken damage, but it could be some other ability, right? Some other contact with a particular creature. And then mechanically, you are now determined to have the disease.
Which puts you in this situation where, as a PC, the best thing you can do to protect yourself against disease is to have a high AC or really good armor. But that mirrors poison more than it does disease. You know, like, we're not really worried about the goblin coughing at us, but for some reason, like, if I take one hit point of damage from the diseased goblin, now I'm worried about catching a disease.
Right. So the way this works in real life, it tends not to be that you've been bit by somebody that you catch a disease outside of tetanus. It tends to be more like you've been exposed to something that is tainted with that disease. So water or, like, you know, infected creatures like rats or mosquitoes.
Yeah. Now, you have options like low-level spells like Purify Food and Drink, or, you know, if you're out in the woods and your characters have survival, they could cook food thoroughly or boil their water, and that works to prevent catching a disease through ingestion. But that doesn't stop them from having to wade through a fetid swamp, or, you know, finding that a passage in the dungeon that they have to get through has been flooded and is now underwater, and who knows what's in that water, or even just, you know, fighting creatures in melee. You're within 5 feet of the thing. It's crawling with fleas, or it's giving off some sort of noxious odor, or releasing spores, or whatever. I mean, weird magical diseases could be extremely virulent, and all you have to do is be in the same room.
Yeah. Also, it's a time-honored tradition amongst adventurers to search the corpses of your fallen foes, or even worse, undead.
Yeah, that zombie was still wearing tattered clothing. Maybe there's coins in the pocket.
Yeah, exactly. You know, those seem like good places that disease could incubate and might become rather virulent if you were to disturb them.
Hmm. Yeah, I like how, and you know, you always have adventurers being like, I'm gonna check for traps. All right, that's great. There are no traps under this fallen corpse. But there's no deck save to dodge microbes, and I'm pretty sure you weren't checking for, I don't know, pus.
Wait a minute. Do we have germ theory? History check.
Do I know what pasteurization is?
Right.
All right. So once one of your characters, or, you know, you as a player have, or you as a character have caught a disease, this is where the rules really start to break down. You know, it usually doesn't spread to others, but that's sort of the operative thing we think about when we're talking about disease in real life. Sure, okay, one person has it, but the really scary thing is when it starts spreading to other people. But most RPG diseases, like, you get it, and then it's a question of whether you're healed from it or whether it gets worse and how exactly it affects you. And occasionally you have ones that'll spread to others, but it's relatively rare. Having your disease spread is a really good way to limit those easy cures.
Yeah, I like this because it doesn't require, like, a magical disease to circumvent spells and healing. Because, like, it's easy if you have one person who immediately comes down with boils and clearly has a disease. The paladin walks up, lays on hands, leaves 5 points of the pool gone, and, hey, now you're magically better, right? But if there's a lag period between showing those symptoms and that player or that character continues on, maybe two or three people are infected over the course of the next few hours, and they're going to show symptoms at different times and be equally contagious to others around them, right? So it becomes less about, can I just touch you and heal you, and more about, how do I deal with this big problem that I need to contain so that I can use this simple mechanic in order to fix it?
Yeah, like, I can cast Lesser Restoration, no big deal, second level spell. And I do that as soon as I see you have boils. That's terrible.
Right.
An hour later, someone else had it.
Yep. Well, I'm going to run out of second level spells.
Yeah, this is getting out of hand. Like, wait, who else is going to show up with these?
Right.
I'm going to wait to see if I have it.
Exactly. So this becomes less about having that solution, right? And more about organizing the world in order to use the solution that you have.
Yeah, if players don't know who is sick, especially if you're getting into a situation where there are NPCs around, then it can become a story element on top of mechanics. Like, who is going to get the cure spell? Like, is the paladin going to make sure that they use all the lay on hands on the children? And, like, you're a grown adult and you're an adventurer, you're just going to need to deal with it. Do people need to be quarantined? What if they don't want to be quarantined? How long do they need to be quarantined? Do you stay here while that happens to enforce it?
Right.
I like the idea that you have these adventurers who are, you know, not all that clean, right? It's hard to get a shower out in the wilderness or in a dungeon where you've been for 5 days exploring corpses. It seems to me that the most likely vector for an ancient, terrible disease to get back out into civilization is on the boots of adventurers coming back out of a dungeon.
Uh-huh.
Or what about that rescue mission where you've got to go, you know, get the merchant back from the hobgoblins, mm-hmm. who probably are also not very clean themselves.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And then, you know, you bring it back to civilization, and now you have to, like, manage the NPCs that it has been spread to, right? And then think about, like, what do you call this disease? This mysterious disease.
That
like,
showed up when this party showed up.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that might be your legacy. Like, right. Patient zero.
Right. Legionnaire's disease, yes, because you're a legionnaire.
Right.
And of course, you know, there are certain kinds of players, maybe myself included, who might say, wait, this spreads very virulently and then makes it difficult for you to fight in combat. How can we keep just one of us infected?
Right.
And then send them in first to fight the enemies. Yeah, weaponized disease is always both creepy but perhaps very effective.
Perhaps never good. Probably never neutral either.
Look, if using poison is always evil, leprosy probably as well. Yeah. Weaponized leprosy.
So in order for this to work, the effects of the disease, right, like the symptoms and even more so like the degenerative effects, the toll that the disease takes on its victim, kind of needs to fall into a sweet spot, right? Like, has to be harmful enough that the character notices it, but not so debilitating that your character is useless and can't do anything to contribute to the adventure any longer.
Yeah, that's no fun. You may as well just be dead. So if we look at the 5th edition D&D Dungeon Master's Guide, it has 3 diseases, which I think sort of serve as interesting examples. You've got cackle fever, which incapacitates you for a minute during combat. You also have sewer plague, which prevents healing on long rest and halves the HP you gain from hit dice. These effects are all bad enough that you must immediately deal with them, right? Yeah. If you like fall down and can't do anything because you're cackling with laughter every time there's combat, you're going to get stabbed. Like, you're going
to
die.
Right. Also, like 10 rounds of combat where you get to do nothing. Sweet.
Right. Super boring. Like, just me as a player, I'm not going to go to a dungeon. I'm not going to pursue the quest.
Right.
If like our quest is now get these people healed.
Right. And like with sewer plague, you know, you can maybe go through one long rest dealing with that. But by the second one, you realize, OK, we got to stop and fix this. This just is we can't move forward with such bad heal rates.
Yeah, it actually becomes a sort of form of reverse railroading where this has now happened and the party can't continue on the quest that they were originally trying to pursue. And even if they do and they're like, no, we must push through for the greater good, they're just going to die.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, you can do that if that becomes a core part of it. The problem is that tends to interrupt the momentum that your story already had, mm-hmm. right? Unless this is an intentional plot point that you're carefully managing. Like, what this is actually doing is saying, hey, pause that cool thing we were building to a crescendo and, like, let's go have a bottle episode over here in this corner for a while. And like, oh, we'll get back to our main plot next week.
Totally. It's totally a bottle episode. Yeah, we're talking about making diseases matter, not making diseases the only thing that count in your game.
Right.
So there is a better option. There's the third disease listed in the Dungeon Master's Guide is a nice example. It's called sight rot. You catch it, and you take a -1 to sight-based tasks. That includes attack rolls or, you know, if you need to read something, whatever. A -1 is not so bad. It's bad enough that you want to get rid of it, but you don't have to immediately do it. But each day, it increases by 1 until after 5 days, you are blinded. Because your eyes are just bleeding, and then they just, you know, bleed shut. So it starts off small, but it is very obvious, right? Your eyes are bleeding. Hey, we need to do something about that. How you feeling? Well, this sucks. I'm obviously taking a mechanical penalty on my dice rolls, but yeah, no, it's a -1. Yeah. Even a -2, you might be like, okay, this is bad. I would like to get this healed as quickly as possible, but you know, we don't need to leave the dungeon immediately.
Right. That's the thing is if you introduce that late, that can be a -1 or a -2 penalty that carries forward to the conclusion and then gets wrapped up in the epilogue. What you don't want it to be is like very early on, I realize how bad this is. And now I got to shunt it off to the side for the side quest to fix my sight rot.
Right. And even when it gets all the way to the end, right, you are blinded. It ends with a crippling, but it's not a permanent injury. You know, specifically in a D&D, traditional D&D setting, you can fix blindness. You know, you can heal eyes. You know, and if I
remove blindness.
Yeah, like lesser restoration cures blindness. Yeah. It's just like, there you go, you can see. you know, like a sci-fi game could be something like
automatic eyes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, or just surgery.
Or like a dope visor.
Like Geordi. Like Geordi the Forge.
Okay.
Is that who you're thinking of?
No,
Star Trek. Who else has a dope visor?
Wait, I was thinking of LeVar Burton in Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah. That's Geordi the Forge.
Okay. Well, his name is LeVar Burton from Star Trek.
Works for me. Okay. You know, he was essentially a butterfly in the sky.
Yeah, he needed that visor to read his rainbow.
He could see so many kinds of electromagnetic radiation, and he very well could see that rainbow and others, ultraviolet rainbows.
Yeah. It's a weird conception of color you've got. Pretty sure he's still only seeing one rainbow.
Three. There's also the infrared rainbows.
I don't think that's a rainbow.
Gamma radiation rainbows. God put the gamma radiation rainbow in the sky to say, I will never again irradiate the Earth because I don't have to.
Okay.
It's going to be irradiated for a very, very long time.
Speaking of curing diseases.
Yeah, you've got a disease. Now you've got to get rid of it. How do you do that?
So, first of all, you have to know what disease you're dealing with. So you need to diagnose it. Which gives you an actual use for the medicine skill that isn't just stabilizing an ally.
Right, finally. Yeah, like, I like the, hey, you don't know who's sick and who's contagious. Does anyone have medicine? No, nobody has medicine. Why would anyone take that?
Right.
Of course, if you are going to diagnose someone, you've got to risk exposure to get close enough to diagnose it, which is another great vector, which I think really sort of mimics the sort of... the physician's dilemma, especially back in the old days when you never necessarily had any idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. You didn't know how things were spread. Like you said, no germ theory. You're just like, I guess I'm going to risk my life by going to see what this patient has.
Yeah, like a leper colony.
Yeah. So even in most RPGs, even when a character has a disease and there's no cure available, like no cure spell, a single save is typically all it takes to fix it, right? It's save or suck for a little while longer, you know, but as soon as you make that DC 13 constitution check, like you're good. Hey, it's gone. Which it's a fine mechanic if you want to use this disease as a little bit of a speed bump, you know, give someone a slight penalty for a few hours or until they can get like a good night's rest. Sure. But 4th edition had this interesting thing called the disease track, where it required multiple saves to either suffer the full effects of the disease or to be completely cured of it, right? So you'd start at one level of it. It had an initial effect. And then if you saved, hey, you were cured. But if you failed, then you got worse. Like a different or similar thing happened. The penalty got worse, or like, you know, being dazed turned into being stunned or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go down on the track, and at the bottom of the track, maybe it was death with a very bad disease, but often it was just you are permanently weakened.
Right.
You know, until you can find some way to actually cure that. And then, you know, as long as you didn't get all the way to the bottom of it with enough successful saves, you could sort of work your way out of that and eventually be cured, even without necessarily magical healing.
So another part of that was that you could, rather than the sick character making a check or a save to manage the disease track, you could let your party members use medicine or heal skills in order to replace that. That pulled other people into solving this problem rather than just like a daily die roll for one character.
Yeah, I really like that mechanic. Like in 5e, what you get now is someone making a constitution saving throw or something like that. And I guess the best that other people can really help is, I mean, I guess the help action.
And it's like resistance sort of, spell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're exactly right. Like a cleric who's casting resistance. But for some reason, the medicine skill doesn't have anything about like long-term tending care. Like, why can't I, as a doctor, you know, help you make that check? I like the idea. Like, I make a medicine check and you use that instead of your save. Done. We're good. It actually makes me effective as a doctor.
Right. Or make a medicine check and give advantage on your save.
Yeah, exactly. Some sort of bonus. So if you go back to the 5e DMG, we've got this sight rot, right, which has a pretty good mechanical effect. It also has a very specific cure that is also not rare, which is nice. So it says, you know, if you can get your hands on the eyebright plant, which is found in a lot of different swamps, you can make a poultice and like this will help cure it. Which is good because if you're in a dungeon, you probably don't have access to it, so you can't just immediately cure this thing. But it's not severe enough that you need to immediately cure it. But as soon as you're out of the dungeon, it's not that difficult to like find a swamp somewhere, go get some eyebright.
Right.
Right. You don't then have to say, okay, now we go on a grand quest to the top of the mountain to find this one flower so that it can cure this random disease. It's, oh, no, we'll go get some eyebright. Okay, that's good. You make a survival check and you're good.
Exactly.
But we're also kind of on a timer because I got 4 days before I'm blind.
Right. And that also pulls in, like, you know, other party members, right? Because it's unlikely the person who is afflicted with sight rot is going to be the one making those survival checks, particularly after suffering the effects of sight rot. Turns out survival by smell, a little more difficult.
Eyebright feels exactly like poison ivy, and that's terrible.
As a hypothetical listener here, I am screaming right now because all of these things are all well and good, except that they're circumvented by a simple thing called magical healing.
Yes, that's the main problem, right? Is I just cast Lesser Restoration, Greater Restoration, or Cure Disease, whatever.
Yeah,
we'll just get rid of that.
Don't even bother creating mechanics for it. And if you do, don't write them down because I'm just going to bypass them.
Yeah, like at mid to high levels, these cures are super easy to come by. So there are a couple of ways to limit magical healing without, you know, being crappy about it. The first one is like you can just be fine with people using magical healing.
Yeah, you can also just overwhelm it with the volume of disease you're facing. Like there are lots of exotic diseases in this dungeon. It is a dangerous jungle.
Yeah, I think like Tomb of Annihilation does that really well, mm-hmm. Which is, hey, everything's gross and you're gonna get sick.
Right. So you have to, you know, choose how many resources to invest in which diseases to cure because it's expensive to do so over time.
Yeah. Also, like those castings are one disease, right? You don't pick all the diseases and get rid of them.
Right. Yeah. You go to one brothel.
Pick up seven diseases.
Three castings. I can live with the other four.
Also, like even if it isn't a volume of diseases, if someone is casting Lesser Restoration, it's a second level spell. Like it's not a ritual. There is an opportunity cost to that. It means that they're not casting something like Invisibility or Hold Person.
Or, you know, Cure Moderate Wounds.
Right, yeah. You know, they're using that resource to fix that disease. They've decided that that's what they want to do. Let them do it. Mm-hmm. You can also, like this eyebright issue, require a specific cure for this likely exotic disease. Now, this only usually works for magical diseases because, you know, you get into the wording of like, why won't you let me use my ability? Lesser Restoration says any disease. There is a bit of a MacGuffin-ness to this, but I think that's kind of fine.
Yeah, you just want to tie the source of the disease to something in the adventure, right? So that it's a magical disease. Like, you know, if there are rumors that prior adventurers who have investigated those ruins have suffered these terrible, like, outcomes later, well, you tie that to the magical disease that they contracted in there that was unbeknownst to you until you caught it.
Yeah, I like this as sort of like a disease as an investigation. You know, the issue isn't so much, you know, going on the quest or, you know, locating a thing or killing a certain monster. It's figuring out what we need to do. And once we actually figure out it, it's pretty simple. But, you know, we have to investigate and experiment a little to figure out what we need. So maybe it's a specific magical ingredient. Maybe there is some sort of quest. You know, that's a MacGuffin. There are lots of different ways to do that. Mm-hmm. Maybe it requires a certain kind of divine magic, right? Like maybe it's a divinely inspired curse or something. Like I could see a disease that can only be cured by someone casting Lesser Restoration who worships a specific god. Mm-hmm. Especially if like that disease is caused by a different god.
Right.
You know? Maybe the caster and the victim both have to believe in the same god. Because that's the catch of the disease.
Lousy outcome for the atheist.
It always is, right? Yeah, yeah. The wall of forgotten souls, right. Or whatever. Also, if you're an actual atheist, you don't really like evidence, do you?
Well, no. I mean, that's interesting. Like, atheism in these settings has to be something more akin to, like, yes, deities are very powerful beings, but, like, they don't deserve our worship. Like, that's stupid.
Right,
like,
Planescape Athar.
Yeah.
Or maybe you can set up some sort of hierarchy. Maybe the paladin's lay on hands works on this disease, but the cleric's magic doesn't, or vice versa. Why is that?
I love tying it to individual people like this. Like, same thing if it would require, like, primal magic or, like, a druid or something to cure, not a cleric. Like, because almost certainly they're willing to help you, but you must prove that you're worthy or do something for them in exchange,
yeah,
or
pay them something, right, fix, like, a problem.
The,
yeah.
The cost will be social instead of simply, like, resources, almost certainly. So what is that going to be? And is that worth it? Or can you just live with a minus five? You tell me.
Yeah, I like that you can build a lot of story elements into that. Maybe the disease is caused by primal or druidic spirits who are not happy with the encroachment of civilization. So your god from the city probably can't cure this because we specifically made this disease to stop you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I like that as magical diseases, not just being punitive and more difficult to take the abilities away from the members of the party, but thematic in trying to reinforce a point. Mm-hmm. You know, there were diseases created for a reason by somebody who was trying to change the world in a certain way.
Right. And even if there wasn't intent behind it, the disease arose out of a certain set of circumstances.
Right.
That if we understand that, we can probably figure out how to actually fix it.
Yeah. Another thing you can do is you can have a disease that cannot be cured by yourself. Like, no matter what you do, you cannot cure it yourself. Somebody else must do it for you. And I love the idea of that being created as, like some god of law or civilization or something, being like,
or
no,
cooperation or something like that.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Like the loner in the woods does not work. Like, you, like, human beings cannot be self-sufficient. They must exist within a social order. So you must use the social order or you will die from this disease.
Yeah. I want this disease to exist. I don't want it to be virulent. I want it to exist so that you always have a reason to cluster together and help each other.
You are very lawful neutral.
You can also, as a way of stymieing easy magical healing, have your disease progress on to physical injury. So sight rot eventually blinds you. It is now no longer a disease that can be cured as a disease. You are just blind. Now, blindness can be cured by a slightly different thing. I mean, in this particular instance, like, lesser restoration cures a disease and blindness, but it doesn't have to
be,
right?
That's a D&D problem, not necessarily an every setting problem.
Right, like if you had a disease that was, making you have a limp, and then you moved at half speed, and you take a penalty to acrobatics and athletics, that would work too. And of course, lesser restoration doesn't fix that.
Right.
It's basically not as bad polio.
Wow.
Fast acting. But even after the polio is gone, there is a lingering mechanical effect. Now, that can then be dealt with, whether that's cybernetic limb, whether that's regeneration or some lower level spell, but it isn't just a simple, I cure disease, I lay on hands.
Right.
Or maybe it makes you blind and deaf. So you gotta cast it twice.
Right. It's also could be fair to have a disease that can't be cured directly, but simply has to run its course. So over time, like, the impact will wax and then eventually wane to nothing.
Yeah, this gives an incentive to really make sure that you don't catch it. But also you're going to want to make sure that it's not a disease that ends up being fatal.
Yeah. And I mean, when we say wax and wane, like, it's got to be a pretty light wax and a pretty quick wane, or at least a light touch there, right? Like, taking a minus one for a long period of time is fine in, like, D&D.
Mm-hmm.
If it escalates to a minus five, then I'm not having fun anymore, right, with that disease. Like, I can't have my sight rot just take time to be restored.
Yeah, I like the idea that you've got to get through the worst part of it in order to get better. Like, you get progressively worse, and the worst day, that when you have the shakes and you've got that minus five, is always the last day. The next day, you're going to be fine. Your fever is going to break.
Right, yeah.
And then you touched on this, but you can definitely run into situations where the cure ends up worse than the disease itself. And then you've got this tension about, like, how badly do I want to be cured? Maybe it, you know, especially these magical diseases, requires some sort of human sacrifice or sacrifice of something that is yours or something that is not yours. And of course, now you're dealing with the person who doesn't want to give that up.
Right. It might also require conversion to a deity or an order or a like pledged or an oath to a group.
Or it could just be that your village is in a terrible location.
Yeah.
You know what cures you? Not living here. Yeah. Also, you can't take your stuff because it's tainted too.
Well, bye, Felicia.
And then as a story element, consider the superstitions that crop up among sick people. Because there is probably a cure to this disease, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people know what it is, even if they think they know what the cure is. I think you can get into some interesting stories where people are 100% sure that doing this action is going to cure them and is actually probably doing the exact opposite.
Oh, right? not just cure, but cause as well.
Oh, yeah. It could be the... Wasn't that like a plot point in Neverwinter Nights, actually?
I think, yeah, because there's...
It totally was.
In the very beginning, uh-huh. Right? And like some people were fatalistic about it, and it was like the punishment of the gods, and other people were like, well, it has to be some type of sabotage by some foul agent.
And then, spoiler alert, there were all these priests going around, like, blessing people to hopefully, like, cure it. But that's how it was being spread.
Mm-hmm. Whoops.
Huh. Yeah, I really like the idea that the specific action people are taking to try to cure it, like, let's, you know, those, that tribe over there is that it's their witchcraft and that is what is causing this.
Right.
Let's go kill all of them. Is like, that's
they were
the
ones keeping it at bay.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's like a bubonic plague. Let's kill all
right.
the cats.
Right.
They were killing the rats.
Right. Yeah, or in like a more engineered virus sort of situation, right? You would biologically engineer an agent that is not only resistant to normal treatment, but is going to be strengthened by the normal course of treatment that like most doctors are going to perform.
Right. It requires a blood transfusion or to keep you from dying.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like
spreads it.
You know, Tylenol bolsters it.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it.
So there is no point in introducing these elements as highlights of your campaign if there aren't long-term consequences, right, to shape the direction of your campaign. So what are some potential impacts?
So I think from history, you can look at often people who had a disease ended up scarred by it in some way, often physically, right? Smallpox scars, you could tell. And especially when you're dealing with like these medieval societies or superstitious societies, it marks you in a way as like being other, like you had this horrible disease. And I don't necessarily know that you don't have it anymore.
Right.
You know, or how do I know that like you aren't still carrying it?
Yeah, disease-based discrimination. That's a theme I want to introduce into my game. Maybe don't go too heavy into that one.
But it is a good excuse for like why a particular group might be on the outskirts.
Right.
You probably don't want to get into a situation where if you have a PC that does it, that like you have scarring that reduces like charisma.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably too strong of a punishment.
No, but it is the type of thing where it's like, it could be recognized, right? And it could be a source of sympathy or a source of like brief mistrust, something mm-hmm. that gets commented on just casually, right? Like something, a little character detail that gets noticed does enough to kind of like remind like the players at the table of like, yeah, remember that disease? Like it, man, it really like screwed your character up, huh? Like, it was a big thing for him.
Yeah, and it can be good for world building too. Like if you have characters who've been in a place for a long time, 10 years later, you see a person with like a particular kind of scarring and you know that you were one of the victims that we actually saved
right.
during that plague that was there for one summer.
Or, you know, if you caused it,
yeah. Like, well, no,
just feel a little more guilty.
Oh, I'm being stabbed. Oh, I understand. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's also, you know, the possibility of creating immunity, like if it is especially like a more conventional disease that is cured through conventional means and not magic, like you would develop antibodies and potentially become immune to that disease.
Which, of course, might be the reason that the party is specifically selected to go on a mission.
Right.
Like, you have to go into these plague-ridden lands because you've all had the plague. You're
right.
Fine.
And then, like, on the flip side of that, there are immune carriers, right? People who carry that immunity that can be used and weaponized against the disease. So you can have the exact same like plot point in reverse. You need to go in to find those people.
Yeah. You can also have flip that and have like Typhoid Marys who themselves are not susceptible to the disease and so don't show any signs of it outwardly, right. But are still spreading it everywhere they go.
Right.
I do like that idea that you brought up, that if a disease is cured magically, you don't develop immunity, right? Because it just wipes it from your body.
Yeah. Like,
but if you have to heal naturally through some sort of saving throw.
Right.
And then you are immune. Yeah, I like that a lot.
And you almost probably have to be a certain level of affected by it to gain that immunity too, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you go the full course of it, you're almost certainly immune if you naturally heal. But if you just kind of like get it and then avoid it, it's like a cold. Like not that virulent of a strain.
There's like, you know, 150 different kinds of poxes.
Right. Smallpox, medium smallpox, medium pox.
Oh, big pox. Big pox are the worst.
Bigly pox.
And then let's just briefly mention curses. I think any disease that you sort of take to the extreme and make it supernatural and make it like a huge plot point is basically a curse. And I think we'll probably talk about them more in depth in another episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main difference between how you treat a curse and how you treat a disease is that curses are almost always intended to be the consequence of a choice, right? Like you have chosen to do something that has then given you this punishment as a result of that choice. Whereas diseases, I think, can be a little bit more random or a little bit less calculated.
Yeah, you don't necessarily deserve the disease.
Right.
The curse, someone thinks you did.
Someone, yeah, exactly. Somebody intends for you to have that curse because of something you did.
Right. But mechanically, you can think about a curse as a disease in terms of how is it contracted, how is it spread, and how is it cured?
By touching the sword.
Yep.
It is spread by touching the sword. It is cured. It's not. Sorry, you're dead.
Yep. It's a curse.
It's cured by, what is it, stone to flesh? Is that the unpetrify?
Flesh to stone cures all ills. I do remember, though, in the 30s when they first started opening like Egyptian pyramids, I liked how, you know, the mummy's curse, like people who opened it kept dying of mysterious circumstances. Mm-hmm. And then it just turned out like it was a disease.
Right.
It was like bacteria that was growing on like 3,000-year-old grain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not like elaborate traps.
Or was it?
Well, it
maybe
was
that's
elaborate
just
traps
the excuse.
Too.
Yeah, we're also elaborate traps. Yes.
I feel like most of those have been triggered by dumb grave robbers in the ensuing like. Or intervening 3,000 years, but who knows?
I should hope so. I don't want to have to go in looking for limestone because that's all gone.
If I'm going to sip this mummy juice, I'm not also going to be dodging a pit trap to do it.
Going to gain all the powers of a mummy.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
That's just me slurping on the mummy juice.
Well, then we are almost certainly going to need a new Ishan soon. So let's move on to the Character Creation Forge. Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at EvilSendsCarne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
So Total Party Thrill is also brought to you by Cobalt Press. Cobalt Press publishes the Creature Codex, which brings you nearly 400 new foes for 5th edition, everything from acid ants to zombie lords.
Yeah, you get a dozen new demons and 5 new angels.
That's
plus
unfair to the angels. What did they do to not deserve full treatment?
Look, the angels are far stronger. Also, what about the devils? What about the devils? I, as a representative of the devils, am here to serve you summons for including no new devils.
Well, the demons are going to reject that summons.
With their teeth.
You can hold them in contempt.
The angels are here to spread a plague.
Well, the angels
with their
are
swords.
The angels will respond to that summons.
Oh, I'm spreading this plague of you being on fire. It is spread by my flaming sword.
There are also wasteland dragons, perhaps caused by an epidemic.
Gross.
And dinosaurs.
There are all new golems, including the Altar Flame Golem, the Doom Golem, and the Keg Golem. I will say, every time I say the words Altar Flame Golem, I'm thinking, ah, this must be some sort of ability that lets this golem change fire to maybe different colors or different sizes. But you, dear listener, who cannot read this, it is altar as in something that you sacrifice something upon.
Oh, see, I was thinking like altered beast, you know, where
okay.
It's just a golem until it becomes flame when it powers up.
I think all of these things are likely true and hidden deep within the pages of the Creature Codex. There are elemental lords and animal lords to challenge powerful parties. chieftains and other leaders for ratfolk, centaurs, goblins, trollkin, and more.
There are new undead, including the Hierophant Lich, to menace lower-level characters.
What do you think Hierophant Lich juice tastes like?
I bet it tastes like Ecto Cooler.
You are correct. It was a test.
The thing is, it's as difficult to pierce the container as a Capri Sun.
You know, flip it upside down.
Yeah, I know. Pop it through the bottom. But then it doesn't sit flat on the table.
So drink it all in one gulp.
Well, I know, but that, yeah.
You can't let that Hierophant Lich juice get warm.
Right, get that sweet, sweet sugar rush.
Plus, if you love DSPN's James Intricasso, and who doesn't, he's one of the designers.
You can use the monsters in your favorite published setting, or populate the dungeons in a world of your own creation with these dangerous, dangerous creatures.
So pick up the Creature Codex on the Kobold Press website, and surprise your players with monsters they won't be expecting unless they listen to this show. Link in the show notes.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building the Ranger-er.
The Ranger-er.
Ranger-er.
The Ranger-er is, of course, more ranger than ranger. See, we're still doing Rob
still
Zombie.
Still doing the Rob
yeah,
Zombie
we're
thing,
still
huh?
doing that. Yeah. Yeah, we're never going to stop.
Okay.
So we've talked about this before. We've complained about this before at length, I think an entire episode, actually. The Rogue and the Ranger have very similar abilities, but the Rogue gets them earlier and does it better. Often.
So instead of dealing with this slight, we are going to build a better Ranger without using the Ranger class.
What else did we do this with? Oh, I think we did with Swashbuckler, right? Swashbuckler with no Swashbuckler.
Well, that was before the Swashbuckler was a thing. Yeah. That was like the very first build was a Swashbuckler.
Yeah. The first two builds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. So what is the Rangerer?
It is Scout Rogue 13, Samurai Fighter 6, Knowledge Cleric 1.
All right. I see where this is going.
Yeah. I think you're going to dig this build.
Mm-hmm. So from Rogue, we will get 7d6 sneak attack dice.
You are extremely mobile and sneaky and evasive. You've got cunning action, you've got uncanny dodge, evasion, you get a 10-foot speed increase, and you can move without provoking when an enemy gets too close to you.
So you will have 6 expertises, 4 from Rogue and 2 from the Scout archetype, which you will have nature, survival, and 4 more of your choice. Plus you will have reliable talent in at least 11 skills.
And eventually you get advantage on initiative, and then the first creature you hit in a combat is going to grant advantage for a round to everybody.
So continuing on this theme of expertise, you'll get 2 more from Knowledge Cleric.
How many is that? 8?
Yeah. All of them? So you'll have Arcana and Religion, along with Nature, which mimics favorite enemy against dragons, elementals, fey, giants, humanoids, beasts, undead.
I think that's pretty much all of them,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And aberrations probably too.
Oh yeah, you're right. That would be in Arcana.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do I know anything about this? Yep, I do.
I sure do.
I know everything about them. I rolled at least an 11.
You will also get 3 cantrips, which of course you'll take guidance, resistance, and something else.
You get the cleric goodie bag of cure wounds, healing word, and bless. Plus you get cleric, like first level cleric ritual. So you know you have ceremony, which look,
hey, get married.
I like if I had the choice, Aragorn would have been the one to conduct my wedding. Okay.
Okay.
But you get things like detect magic, detect poison and disease, which remember also detects poisonous creatures, mm-hmm. which is very rangery, and of course purify food and drink. So from fighter, you're getting 2 ASIs in just 6 levels, extra attack, action surge, and another skill.
Of course.
Plus, you'll also get Fighting Spirit 3 times a day, which gives you 5 temp HP and advantage on all your attacks for a round, which if you don't have advantage and there's no other way for you to gain sneak attack, you Fighting Spirit, you'll get sneak attack. Try to make sure it's also the same round when you also action surge.
Right. So in terms of leveling order, I think we want to start with Rogue 4.
Grab that ASI.
Go ahead and do that. Then get Cleric 1. Then take all of your fighter levels and finish it out with Rogue.
If you don't want to make sure that you have no Ranger in this build, you can just sub Ranger for fighter and you kind of get like this super Ranger.
Super Ranger.
Like the most Ranger.
Super Ranger.
Ultra Ranger.
Mega Ranger.
Ultra Mega Ranger.
Sunday, Sunday, Sunday.
By your Rangers combined.
So, Ishan, who is your Rangerer?
All right, my Rangerer, in keeping with the theme of this episode, she is a leprosy victim.
Okay.
She is unclean. The person that you meet on the road and must shout, by law, I am unclean. Keep your distance. You don't want to catch this disease from me. So she's an archer. Doesn't get anywhere near the rest of the party. Stays away. Makes sure that they don't get infected. But she's extremely effective from range. And is the tracker, the hunter, lives out in the woods. Probably actually doesn't go to the inns with the rest of the party. She like stays in the outskirts or maybe just out in the woods, and the rest of the party meets up with her and they're like, hey, how have you been? And she's like, I've already checked our quarry. I know where they are. Do you want to get moving?
Okay.
How was the food? Mine was delicious. I hunted and killed it myself.
Okay.
I actually like this even more if there is an actual ranger in the party.
Right, yeah.
Who she keeps calling soft.
This is the problem. You're going to dunk on a party member.
Okay, maybe a ranger NPC. How about that?
Perfect. Someone you can fearlessly antagonize.
And, you know, it's probably some sort of, like, MacGuffin disease, right? Because I actually don't want her cured of it until maybe very later, some sort of quest. Shane, who is your rangerer?
My rangerer is a traveling, visiting professor who spends his time going through ancient ruins, you know, deep in the wilderness, a lot of jungles, a lot of deserts, a lot of inhospitable regions where he has been expertly trained, maybe an Indiana Jones or a Lara Croft or a Nathan Drake type figure.
Any of those,
Yeah, your pick. But yeah, like, so that's what he does, as sort of fueling his research,
right? It's the library ranger. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's the librarian ranger.
Yeah. I'm going to track my enemy in the pages of this tome.
Well, I got to figure out where he's likely to be. And then when I get there, you've always got survival expertise.
That's right. You track where the enemy's going to be, not where they are right now.
Where they should be. All right. Before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
You can also leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and we will read it on the air. Today we've got Great D&D Podcast, 5 stars by Hyperlexic. I found these guys through the Don't Split the Podcast Network. They share my love of... Wait, is that the same one as last week?
No, this one just also says Everton.
Okay. I found these guys through the Don't Split the Podcast Network. They share my love for Everton, so they can't be all bad. Seriously, they have a good viewpoint in gaming and are a pleasure to listen to. So, yep, another typo or another autocorrect fail for Eberron and Everton.
So many soccer players listen to us. Also, what's the Don't Split the Podcast Network?
We're gonna end up with a lot of hooligans.
We welcome you. We welcome you, hooligans.
I support Liverpool.
I support... I don't know. I don't know anything about this.
I don't. I'm actually an Arsenal guy, but Everton's rival is Liverpool.
I don't know what that means, but that's okay. I agree with you.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are talking about scrying and remote viewing.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we're building the Eye of Horus.
Well, that's it for episode 166 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
I'm Lisa Chen, and I host Behold Her, a monthly podcast that shines a spotlight on women in the world of tabletop games. There are so many women to behold in this amazing hobby, and our experiences as female gamers are as diverse as we are as individuals. Through one-on-one interviews, audio essays, and panel discussions, all centered around a monthly theme, the guests on Behold Her share their unique stories as players, game masters, designers, artists, organizers, and so much more. Their words are inspiring, uplifting, and informative. Check out Behold Her Podcast wherever podcasts are found, or visit beholdherpodcast.com.